death. She was deemed psychologically unfit and therefore uncredible. But as you are well aware, corpses never lie. My thoughts returned to the moment, during Andrea's autopsy, when I'd pulled a foot-long worm from her abdomen. I do find it surprising that she only recently became ill. It's been 20 years. This is not an organism that longs to inhabit the body for any great amount of time. Police said she was homeless on the island. Maybe she got herself infected. I have no explanation. I played no part in your father's sadistic studies, nor have I gone out of my way to contact this woman after what she did to me. Yet you're here for something. What is it? I want you to alter the report. I snorted at that and poured myself another drink, uncertain if the crazy son of a bitch was serious or joking. You are asking me to falsify my findings? Don't you dare get technical and legal with me. Remember who saved your ass last year with that Herrick girl. Yet another scandal with absolutely no merit. Your family name has cost me excessive damage control. I'm simply asking you to remove the toxin detail. And the bone striations? How the hell do I explain that in the absence of any genetic abnormalities or dysplasia? Strike that binding as well. Groaning, I rubbed a hand down my face, listening to him turn a simple report into a complex web of lies that even a novice pathologist worth his salt could untangle. She has an entire medical profile based on the damage this organism has caused. What happens when someone questions my findings and she's exhumed? She's due to be cremated afterward. Neither the hospital, medical examiner, nor this university is interested in absorbing the cost of a burial. As I understand, they've tracked an uncle who can sign for cremation. Therefore, your report is the gospel. Quietly remove those findings and no one will be the wiser. Falsifying a report was nothing new. I'd done it before, with reasonable and logical explanation. Trying to conjure a reason for every physiological assault this woman had endured, however, was a puzzle I didn't need thrown into my lap. You think I'm a bastard for requesting such a thing? I twirled the last bit of liquor in my glass, convincing myself it'd be a bad idea to bash his face with it. I'm more impressed that you could so easily ask me for a favor that would cost me my license. What is it you want in exchange, Deverick? Now we were talking. I could justify the work for a bargain. I want the cameras removed from my laboratory. Those cameras are a requirement of funding. They're in place as a result of... I know why they're in place. I tipped my head just enough to stretch the scar that spanned from my neck to elbow. An acid attack, courtesy of the ever-vigilant student body who'd felt compelled to villainize me for the disappearance of a girl, without proper evidence, of course. I'd spent 2 months on hiatus, recovering from it, which had put me further behind in my work. I do not work with student assistants, as I've explained a number of times to the board. Why do you insist they be removed, then? I don't appreciate feeling as if I'm being watched while I work. It upsets my focus. Quietly have them removed, and no one will be the wiser. I echoed his words from just moments ago. Fine, consider it done. Legs crossed, he looked around my office and took a sip of his liquor. I couldn't help fantasize how incredibly gratifying it would be to slip a few larvae into his drink. Of course, that was just laziness talking. I loathed the idea of having to edit my report. I'm surprised I managed to catch you in office hours at all. It's a wonder you sleep. Lippincott pushed his empty glass onto the desk. How is the research coming along? My mind wouldn't let it go. This fantasy, so vivid and entertaining. Thinking about those wriggling things making their way down his esophagus and into his belly. Snap out of it, Deverick. I cleared my throat, rolling my shoulders back. Steady and tedious, as always. Any headway in the latest variant? Yes. I now have a moth with a fully extended proboscis that'd prefer a nice, rare steak over sliced oranges. I find that utterly fascinating. If it didn't equate to failure, I might as well. I don't mean to add further pressure, but with the quarterly evaluations coming up, there will be unwanted interest in the program. His hands curled around the arm of the chair, and the muscles in his face tensed. It was no mystery what had his panties twisted. having to face members of the Rooks, those practically born into excessive power, with a stagnant report wouldn't be an easy task. Fortunately, I enjoyed a somewhat insulated status, in that my lineage with the group went so far as my great-great-grandfather, one of the founders. It was the only reason the Rooks hadn't thrown my father into one of their pretty cages after the humiliation he'd caused. Humiliation that I'd since been tasked with sopping up. While ambitious and brazen enough to climb the ladder of power, Lippincott was only a first-generation Rook, nouveau riche, who only married into money, and his not being born into it made him practically expendable, easily knocked from his rung if he were to fuck up. I've commandeered the Midnight Lab to assist in moth propagation and inoculation, in hopes of testing multiple variants at once. I offered as a stale consolation. It didn't matter how long I took to complete my work. Unless I suddenly became a threat to the society, I'd suffer nothing more than a slap on the wrist. Lippincott, on the other hand, carried the weight of failure. Fortunately for him, I had other reasons riding my ass to stay motivated. Most notably, the fact that, at any moment, every muscle in my body could lock up and seize, including my heart, and throw me into cardiac arrest. So yeah, I felt the pressure. But we are still far from human clinical trials. Lippincott slumped in his chair like a child who wasn't getting what he wanted for Christmas. Inoculating a human at this stage would be disastrous, deadly, irresponsible. An image of the alley drunk I had locked in a cell right then flickered through my mind. As will failure to produce results. Bear in mind the difficulty in getting this study approved, particularly with a Bramwell at the helm. He rubbed his hands together, clearly anxious. My opportunity to become president of this institution depends on the success of this Devrick. I'm counting on you to come through with results. Your study could change the entire landscape of medicine and pharmaceuticals. As if I needed him to remind me. The man hadn't set foot in a lab in 20 years. At one time, he was brilliant, but he'd chosen politics and administrative drama instead, a path I avoided with the fervor of an unwanted syphilis infection. I look forward to your next IBS report. I need more time. The toxins produced by this parasite are ever-changing and evolving, practically turning into monsters with their teeth and scorpion tails. If it's more time you need, I'll make that happen. But know that there will be enormous pressure placed on the university in the upcoming months. The board, the sponsors, they want success. They want results. The promise of this study was the only redeeming point for the sponsors. I'll have results. Of course you will. That's where you and your father differ. His gaze fell toward my hand, where I'd placed a band-aid on my little parasitic love bite. What happened there? Paper cut. Nothing serious. He snorted. Until it becomes infected, grows some resistant form of bacteria, and turns into septicemia. I washed it, Edward. Thoroughly. With a chuckle, he tapped his knuckles on my desktop as he pushed to his feet. I'll let you get back to it then.
Chapter 11. Lilia. The blare of a horn startled me, and I awoke on a gasp pressed against the cool pane of a window. Drool wet my cheek, and I dragged my arm across my face in as subtle a movement as I could, glancing around to see other passengers also rousing out of sleep. In the moon's light, a thick fog hovered over the water as I peered through the window toward the ocean in the distance. The ocean. I'd only seen it once as a teenager. As much as my sister and I always dreamed of going to the beach, my mother had always refused, opting instead for camping trips in the woods. As if my mother had feared the water. I found it mesmerizing.
Attention, passengers, we've arrived at Thresher Bay, Maine, where the time is 5:06 in the morning. Weather is a balmy 64 degrees with patches of thick fog. The ferry will depart at approximately 5:30 to transport you to Jacadia Island. Please gather your luggage and be sure to watch your step on the exit ramp. If this is your first year at Jacadia, congratulations and welcome.
The train entered an enormous glass dome and slowed to a stop between two other station trains, each separated by a narrow platform on which a clock stood upright above a sign with the next departures. Across from me sat a guy about my age. He removed his earbuds, his bright blue eyes a stunning contrast to his dark skin, staring past me, presumably toward the window at my other side. I felt a small bit of relief on seeing someone else not clad in designer clothes. Having unbuckled myself, I pushed to my feet and waited as a line of passengers made their way to the luggage rack. An inexplicable tension wound through me as I eyed my suitcase too far away to grab. "Relax. Nobody wants your damn suitcase." At the end of the lineup, the kid across from me gestured to let me go first. And with an appreciative nod, I stepped out into the aisle behind everyone else.
"First year?"
he asked, falling in line behind me. Lips tight, I smiled. "Is it obvious?" I hoped so, considering I was about 2 years older than I should have been for a first year.
"You just look a little nervous."
"I'm actually a sophomore, but it's my first year at the university. What about you?" The line moved forward, and I slid my suitcase off the rack, stumbling forward as I hefted it into the narrow aisleway.
"Sophomore."
He pulled a much fancier suitcase off the rack, and in the brief moment before the line moved forward, stuck out a hand.
"Name's Bryson Williams."
I returned the handshake. "Lilia, nice to meet you."
"You too. Where are you from?"
I glanced over my shoulder at a blonde passenger who was busy scrolling through Instagram and turned back around, lowering my voice. "Covington."
"Ah, home of the Luminette."
Lips stretched to a smile, he shrugged.
"I'm a few towns over in Landsmint, and I'm kind of a theater nerd."
Last I checked, Landsmint was the second most wealthy city in Massachusetts. Yet I didn't feel like a pauper around him. In fact, I found him to be relatable. "I actually live above the theater," I said.
"Seriously? No way, I'm so jealous."
He chuckled and gave a jerk of his head, alerting me that the line had moved forward. "Yeah," I said over my shoulder, making my way for the exit. "I know just about every word to Les Miserables at this point."
"I do too, but for different reasons, I suppose."
All of us made our way down the platform toward the main part of the station.
"What are you studying?"
With the wider space, he strolled up alongside me, the two of us walking side by side. "Medical microbiology? You?"
"Chemistry."
"Wow, redox balancing. Hated that with every fiber of my being."
"Simple computation."
"Ah, that was a subtle insult." I chuckled, my arm straining as my suitcase bounced over the cracks in the concrete behind me. The station opened out onto a road, where everyone crossed to the ferry boat launch across the street. Pale rays of sunlight had begun to crest over the clouds, though it would probably be another half hour or so before sunrise. Eyeing a statue out in front of the launch, I studied the stony profile of a man in a colonial-style uniform. The placard at his feet read, "Lord Commodore Adderley," and below that, "In memory of those who perished en route to Dracadia." As I followed everyone onto the small boarding bridge, I caught sight of the murky ocean water below. I'd never been on a boat before, and I really hoped I didn't get seasick, especially in front of a load of people I'd only just met for the first time. Just as on the train, we all stored our luggage in a small rack. Bryson gave a slight jerk of his head.
"If you tend to get a little nauseous like I do, the cabin is probably best,"
he said, as if reading my mind. A nervous smile lifted the corner of my mouth and I nodded. "Yeah, okay." He led the two of us inside an enormous passenger cabin with tables and benches, and gestured toward a seat by a small window. Being enclosed by walls had me feeling less vulnerable, and I slid onto the bench across from him. "How long is the ride to Dracadia?"
"About 90 minutes or so. Not too long."
"So the university, what's it like?"
"It's a great school. Beautiful campus. If you can get past the ghosts and creepy history."
"A chem major who believes in ghosts?" He snorted a laugh.
"I didn't believe in a lot of things before I attended this school, but it comes with the territory. You kind of just have to roll with it."
After a short announcement from the captain, the ferry idled away from the dock, and I peered out of the window to see the ocean water splashing up as we picked up speed. I'd studied the map of Dracadia, had seen its position miles out into the Gulf of Maine, where I'd read that the water reached depths of over 1,000 feet in some spots. The thought sent a shiver across the back of my neck. Please don't send any tidal waves to tip the boat over. Getting stranded in the middle of the ocean happened to be a recurring nightmare for me for some reason. My therapist had told me that it might have been my mind feeling trapped in my circumstances. Google had suggested that I might soon be facing a dangerous time in my life. I hoped it was just a stupid nightmare that didn't mean much of anything at all. Have you actually seen a ghost or something? I asked Bryson, searching for distraction from the gurgling in my stomach. As much as I wanted to stare out at the ocean, seeing it dip and swell with the waves sent a cold tickle to my chest, and I decided against the possibility of painting the table between us in puke.
All I'm going to say is, you might see some weird stuff, but as far as I know, no one was ever killed by a ghost there.
Well, that's good to know. He hiked his arm up over the top of the bench and eased back into his seat.
So, what does a medical microbiologist do?
I want to study diseases, find cures, you know, save the world. You?
Would you believe me if I said, I don't know. I'll probably become a professor and mold the minds of those who have their shit together better than I do.
Well, at least you have a plan. Somehow, an hour and a half passed with light conversation, and only a minor case of nausea that I was able to keep in check by breathing hard through my nose. Watching the sun rise over the horizon, its salmon-colored rays stretching across the water's surface also provided some distraction, fleeting as those golden rays disappeared too quickly behind the gloom of overcast. When finally the dark silhouette of the island could be seen through the fog, I marveled at the arched curve that did, in fact, look like a sleeping dragon. Gray clouds, swollen with rain, loomed like puffs of black smoke billowing upward.
Hello, Jacadia,
Bryson said, peering through the window. Wow, it's beautiful.
Even more beautiful up close.
The boat ferried through the crack in the rock, beneath the arch, toward the other side of the island. Stony spires speared the sullen sky over the dark, wispy crowns of the pine trees which cloaked the university grounds. The ferry's engine slowed as the boat tottered across the choppy waves toward a stone, castle-like structure at the foot of the cliff, whose center looked like it had been carved into an archway. Flickering torches lit the way through the small tunnel, which opened up into a domed interior where a number of small boats had been docked. Attendants inside the rocky boathouse scurried around the ferry, tying it up as we made our way toward the ramp. Standing on deck beside all the stacked luggage, a middle-aged man smiled at me, and as I reached for my suitcase, he set a gentle hand on my arm.
I got it, miss. Your luggage will be delivered to your dorm room.
That same uneasy feeling as before nagged at me. I suspected every other student on the ferry could have probably afforded to replace a wardrobe or missing gadgets, but that wasn't the case for me. If he lost it, or worse, it got stolen, I'd have nothing.
Trust me,
he added, and I realized that I was still clutching the handle of my bag.
You're not going to want to drag this thing up the hill.
At that, I bowed to the side, noticing through the brick tunnel where the path disappeared up the mountainside.
Don't worry, they're really good about delivering everything with care,
Bryson said behind me.
I was a little uncomfortable at first, too.
From his coat pocket, the attendant pulled a pen and flipped through the first few pages of the clipboard, clutched in his other hand.
Name?
Lilia Vespertine.
Lilia. Ah, yes, Crickson House, room 310.
He peeled away a sticker from the page and secured it to my luggage. Okay, thanks. I threw one more glance toward my suitcase before exiting the boat. A stone platform led toward the tunnel, and I stepped in that direction, assuming it was the way to my dorm, when a grip of my arm brought me to a stop. Bryson released me, pulling a messenger bag up onto his shoulder.
Hey, can I get your phone number?
Oh, I'm not...
Oh, it's not like that. I have a boyfriend.
A lopsided smile slanted his lips as he scratched the back of his head. Idiot. I silently chided myself. I somehow had to pry myself from the mindset that every guy who asked for my number was looking for a hookup. Right, sorry, yes. As we made our way toward the tunnel, I rattled my cell phone off to him, and he sent me a text with a smiley face emoji that said, hello.
And now you have mine. I just thought it'd be cool to exchange theater lines sometime.
Smiling, I nodded. I'd like that. Lilia? Is there a Lilia Vespertine? At the sound of my name, I turned toward a bright-eyed blonde who, like the attendant, also carried a clipboard. Bryson gave me a light shoulder tap.
I'll catch you later. Good luck.
Thanks. You too. On those parting words, I headed toward the blonde who'd called me. I'm Lilia, I said, strolling up to her. After an appraising once-over, she flashed a too-wide smile that creased her eyes. I'm Kendall. I work with the dean's office. Dr. Langmore asked that I fetch you for a quick introduction. Of course. I trailed after her, away from the tunnel and up a winding stone staircase to what looked like a gondola ski lift. Some students, including Bryson, took the walking path that led upward toward the castle-like building ahead, and as I stared down dozens of feet below me, I could see them making the steep climb. Once we'd settled onto our seats, the gondola lurched into motion, exiting from its tower, and at that height, I could finally take in the breathtaking school grounds set against the ocean backdrop. Sunrise fought to break through the overcast, offering a soft glow over the bustling campus as students arrived for the new semester. The university buildings were arranged in a square, enclosed by an ancient stone wall that lined the perimeter of the surrounding woods, like a small village made up of weathered buildings with their pointed arches and ribbed vaults, some covered in sprawling vines with lush gardens and courtyards interspersed between them. Wealth flowed through the veins of the university. That much was clear. Yet, deep within its bones hid the slumbering tragedies of its past, ones that had bled through in the irreparable decay that had aged the exterior like a smoldering infection. Dracadia was once a monastery, Kendall said, staring out through the gondola window. And an asylum, right? Yes. It has a rather dark history, but I'm sure that wouldn't impress someone like you. At that, I frowned, not quite catching her meaning. While a snarky comeback sat perched on the tip of my tongue, I didn't want that on my first day, so instead, I turned back toward the window, and for the rest of the ride, I remained quiet as she prattled on about student life on campus. When the gondola finally slowed to a stop on the grounds of the monastery, I stepped out onto a narrow platform and down a flight of stairs, which led out to the manicured lawn of an expansive courtyard. From there, I followed after her, cutting through the center of campus, toward what must have been the main admin building. Situated directly across from an enormous clock tower at the opposite end of the courtyard, the building rivaled the height of every other on campus. My eyes wandered in awe of the place. Before we entered the building and headed up to the second floor, to a hallway of offices, something tingled the back of my neck as we slowed to a stop at a door where a gold plaque engraved with Dr. Gilbert Langmore hung beside it. Wait here one moment. Kendall knocked on the door before slipping inside. The sound of a voice carried down the corridor, and I turned toward a slightly ajar door, catching sight of a man who slouched in his chair with a bored expression as another man, unseen from my angle, spoke without taking a breath. When the bored man turned toward me, that tickle in the back of my neck flared again. Copper-colored eyes set beneath long black lashes and a naturally stern brow stared back at me. The shift of his jaw dragged my attention toward the perfection of his profile, sharp and angular and shadowed in a light stubble. A shivering warmth scattered beneath my skin and fluttered in my chest as he gave an aloof blink of his bedroom eyes before turning back toward the voice. Lilia? Kendall's voice snapped me out of my staring. Dr. Langmore is ready to see you now. Nodding, I cleared my throat, stealing one more glance of the man who didn't bother to look my way again.
Ah, Miss Vespertine, come in.
Behind the desk sat an older man with graying hair and spectacles. He pushed up from his chair, gesturing to the one across from him where I took my seat.
I trust you had a long morning, so I will keep this meeting brief so that you can get settled. I'm Dr. Langmore, and I would like to personally welcome you to Dracadia University.
He settled back into his chair.
I was thoroughly impressed by the paper you wrote for Professor Wilkins.
Thank you, sir, I said, gaze trailing over the walls where inspirational quotes hung beside framed degrees that highlighted each step of his credentials. Displayed on his desk sat a picture of him in a deep burgundy tuxedo, his arms wrapped tightly around a slightly taller, slimmer man in a pale pink tuxedo.
Your analysis was exceptionally detailed. May I ask how you designed this particular organism?
I didn't know why I still harbored a sense of duty in upholding my mother's privacy. She was dead, after all. And I had little doubt the organism responsible was something I'd since learned rarely infected humans. I wanted to tell Dr. Langmore that I knew firsthand how the disease affected a human being, because I'd watched it every day for weeks. Instead, I smiled and shrugged. Just a basic understanding of parasites paired with a wild imagination.
Interesting.
Wearing a pensive expression, he adjusted his spectacles and nodded.
I look forward to seeing that knowledge blossom during your time here. As stated in my letter to you, all expenses are paid while you're here. I want you to feel comfortable in this environment. If you need anything, I want you to reach out to me personally.
Wow. I'd never been personally greeted by the dean of any college, let alone invited to contact him. I appreciate your hospitality. Hospitality? Was that even the right word?
You've received your dorm assignment, correct?
Yes, sir.
Good, good. Any questions regarding your classes?
One, yes. There is a parasitology class and accompanying lab that was already on my schedule. I looked at the requirements, and it seems I've not taken the prereq for that class.
Yes, I enrolled you in that rotation. That's Professor Bramwell's midnight lab. No worries. I'm certain you'll do well there.
Bramwell? The expert Professor Wilkins had mentioned the day he'd given me the invitation. I'm sorry, I didn't realize he taught it. The course guide listed...
His associate professor and teaching assistant. Dr. Bramwell oversees the course and gives the lectures for the accompanying class. But his associate and teaching assistant run the midnight lab and recitations. Dr. Bramwell is the lead in charge.
I see. There's another class I didn't sign up for as well. Entomology. I'm assuming you put me in that class too?
No. That was likely Dr. Gilchrist. She's the department chair for the College of Natural Science. The one who petitioned your enrollment.
Yes, Dr. Wilkins informed me.
I'm imagining she hoped to have you in her class, but you're welcome to remove it, if you'd like.
No, that's okay. I'll leave it.
Very good. Now, Miss Vespertine, I imagine you're quite tired. Get settled, get some rest, and allow me to welcome you to Jocadia. I'll have Kendall show you to your dorm.
Chapter 12. Lilia. Shit. Like an idiot, I decided to look for my assigned dorm alone while exploring the campus a bit along the way. I stared down at the map I'd gotten from the dean's secretary, twisting it around in a poor effort to figure out where the hell I was. Leave it to me to get lost in a perfect square. I glanced up toward the building where I'd stopped, an ominous tower whose lichen-covered surface, laced in lush green vines, gave it a much older appearance than the other buildings on campus. Etched into the stone was a plaque indicating it was Emmerich Tower. The campus boasted six different houses, each with its own crest, beautiful dormitories with their flags waving proudly out front, none of which appeared to be Crickson Hall, at least not on the map I was looking at. Growling in frustration, I spun around and straight into an unyielding wall of man. A burning humiliation thoroughly heated my face as I stepped back. I'm sorry. I trailed my gaze up a black button-down shirt to a perfectly chiseled face with copper eyes blazing in irritation. The handsome man I'd seen back at the dean's office. Without a word, he stepped around me. Excuse me, I called after him, but he didn't so much as acknowledge me. The warmth in my face intensified with my growing irritation, and I twisted the map around, trying to figure out where the hell I was. I scanned my surroundings, watching students bustle to and fro, all of them well-composed and dressed like they belonged in an academia editorial spread. I zeroed my attention on a woman about my age, hoofing it toward me. Long black hair cascaded over her shoulders, and her berry red lipstick emphasized the pallor of her skin. She wore a crop top with a skull on the front, and black-and-white striped pants paired with red boots. A bit eclectic from what I'd seen so far. Maybe she was an art major or something. Excuse me. My voice hardly carried over the hum of voices, but she ground to a halt and twisted toward me, one pierced brow raised. I'm looking for Crickson House. It's not on the map. Because it's not called Crickson. Wait, what? The guy at the dock told me we call it Crickson. But its actual name is Corbeau House. As soon as she said the name, I snapped my attention back to the map, finding it directly across campus from where we stood. Ah. She gave a jerk of her head. Come on, I'm headed that way. Falling into step behind her, I stuffed the map into my bag. I'm Lilia, by the way. I'm Melisandre, she said over her shoulder. Mel, for short. You're new at Dracadia? Yes, it's my first day. I feel a little like a fish out of water. Finally caught up to her, I glanced around at all the other students, who seemed to know exactly where they were going as they buzzed past with determined strides. So, Crixon, why do you call it that? Are you familiar with the Crixon study? At the shake of my head, she nodded. Figured as much. There's a whole conspiracy theory about how they tried to suppress all the information about it. They? The Rooks. They're Dracadia's super secret society, she said on a dramatic whisper, while I chewed on the news that secret societies actually existed outside of books and movies. Anyway, the rumor has it they were somehow involved in this clinical trial that happened about 20 years ago. A bunch of women were invited to participate in some study for a new medication that supposedly reversed diabetes. They all stayed in Corbeau Hall, which, as you saw on the map, is somewhat separate from the campus. It did seem hidden in the illustration of trees that surrounded it. So yeah, one night, 6 out of the 8 women drowned themselves in Squelette Lake. And voila, 6 skeletons were swept under the rug. All 6? Like, at the same time? Yup. As we passed another dark-haired girl who flipped her off, Mel smiled and blew her a kiss. Some kind of weird mass suicide. What happened to the other two? No one knows. They just disappeared. Some say they live in the tunnels beneath the dorm. Others say they were murdered and their souls haunt Crixon Hall. It's mostly just staff who refer to the dorm as Corbeau. Confused, I shook my head. The Rooks conducted this study? Well, they played some role. Dr. Death's father was the project's primary investigator. Dr. Death? My gaze wandered the lush greenery of the campus courtyard, with its benches and aged statues. The stone walkways that weaved through well-kempt gardens and hedges. Professor Bramwell, he's the pathology professor. Why do you call him Dr. Death? Well, aside from the fact that he plays with corpses all day, he was allegedly involved in a totally separate disappearance 2 years ago. A student by the name of Jenny Herrick was a total scandal. Rumor has it that he got jealous of her boyfriend and killed her. One of those, if I can't have her, no one can deals. Really? That didn't add up to a man who was considered brilliant in his field. I knew brilliant men. I'd worked alongside them. They rarely noticed anything outside of their own bubble. Yeah, he's got scars across his neck and shoulder. Her boyfriend snapped, stole some sulfuric acid from the chem lab and attacked him. She snorted a laugh at that, as if it wasn't an absolutely horrific visual she'd just planted in my head. Boyfriend was permanently expelled, and Dr. Death got off with nothing more than a slap on the wrist. But you said disappearance. So not a confirmed murderer or anything. She rolled her eyes. Okay, fine. Disclaimer, all accusations of murder are based on speculation and rumor. Except that she never turned up. And he was the last to see her alive. Happy? Jeez, touchy. I was just clarifying that there wasn't actual proof that he'd murdered her. The shady overhang of trees swallowed the open space as the path continued on through a shallow forest, beyond which I could see a stone building ahead, one that looked significantly aged compared to the rest of the dorms we'd passed. It sounds like you believe the rumors? She shrugged. I believe in the underdog, and I can assure you Professor Bramwell is no underdog at this university. He's old money, and old money at this school equates to power. Going back to the Crixon study, you said not much is known about it. How do you know so much about it? Research. I wanted to know why everyone on campus avoided the dorm. You dig in a cemetery, you eventually find a bone. We crossed the yard and arrived at the entrance of the building, where dark, weathered stones covered in moss and vines made for an eerie exterior. Anyway, here it is. Crixon House. The flag sticking out from the pediment of the building's entrance bore a purple and black shield with a raven, or crow, it was hard to tell which. One of the original buildings when the place was still a monastery, before some of the buildings burned down. Was that recent? No, centuries ago. It's what the whole Adderley Monument is about back at Thresher Bay. That we commemorate a British soldier who drove off the natives on the island and participated in the burning of accused witches is precisely what's wrong with this country. I recalled having seen the monument just before boarding the ferry. Why would they commemorate him? Because no one gives a shit about the actual history. You have to scrape past all the lies to get to the truth. In their minds, he's some kind of savior for having killed off a bunch of deranged patients and savages, she said in air quotes. What we would call those with mental illness nowadays, but back then they were possessed by demons. Sighing, she shook her head. Anyway, I'll spare you. What floor are you on? Third. I'm the RA for the third floor. If you smoke, crack a window or light some incense. All rooms in Crixton have ensuite bathrooms, so if you drink, hide the evidence in the shower during rounds. We never check the showers. And if you decide to have company over, I suggest the basement if you're a moaner. I'm actually pretty quiet. I'm just here to study. She snorted and rolled her eyes. That's what every student here says on their first day. Anyway, check in at the front desk for your room's key card. Don't lose it. And if you haven't yet gotten your ID card, go do that right away. You need it for the dining room. Dracadia Bookstore is at the opposite side of the clock tower in the plaza. She waved her hands in a dismissive way, as if trying to flap away all the information flying out of her mouth at once. It's like its own small village, with lots of cool little shops there. Thanks. I appreciate the help. No problem. Oh, and one other thing. Unless you have class at Emmerich Tower, I'd stay away from there, if I were you. Particularly at night. A glance at my schedule earlier indicated that I did have a class there. At least three of them. One at night. Why? It's just creepy. It's where Dr. Death actually works. There's a morgue for the cadavers and whatever autopsies he performs, and an incinerator room. He performs autopsies here on campus? Only special cases. The university hospital is about 2 miles outside of campus, just past downtown Emberwick, the small village I'd only acquainted myself with on a Google search before I'd arrived. You don't actually see the bodies, thank goodness, unless you're in the med school program. They bring them in through the tunnels outside of the gate. Interesting. The more I learned about Professor Bramwell, the less I seemed to be able to visualize the man who'd garnered such a dark and macabre moniker. He performs these autopsies by himself? Yeah, he's not the friendliest guy. Like I said, unless you have to be on that side of campus, maybe just steer clear. I couldn't tell if she was trying to scare me, knowing it was my first year there, or being genuine in her warning. Got it. Nothing she'd said had scared me, though. I'd already seen my fair share of ghosts and dangerous men. At least the ones at Dracadia wouldn't smell like a grave digger. After checking in with the front desk for my key card, I was directed down the hallway to an office where they took an unflattering photo of me for an ID card, attached to a black and gold Dracadia lanyard. From there, I finally made my way to my room. The key card clicked green as I stuffed it into the card reader and turned the knob, before swinging the door open to a small but cozy room with shiny hardwood floors and a simple bed. The dorms, while rich with antiquity, seemed to offer a few modern features. To my left was a small walk-in closet made of thick wood in the same shade as the rest of the room, with a heavy-looking dresser pressed against the wall. A lot of storage space that I likely wouldn't fill. The window on the south-facing wall showed the ocean in the distance, and at the opposite wall sat an actual desk and chair, which looked out onto Dracadia's courtyard. Why the room hadn't been snatched up right away with such a beautiful, almost panoramic view was an absolute mystery. My suitcase had been placed beside my bed, and on the mattress sat a stack of folded white sheets next to a folded black sweatshirt and t-shirt with the gold Dracadia logo. Beside those was a small black satchel that I opened to find a pin, a journal, a pad of paper, pen, and water bottle, all with the same school colors and logo. A small card tucked inside read, "Welcome to Corbeau House, fellow Dracadian." As I smiled down at it, a strange and foreign sensation swept over me, for the first time since my mother had died. I felt a sense of belonging.
Chapter 13. Beverick. I feel Fucking great, Barletta said. Aside from sleeping most of the day, turning into a bit of a night owl lately. But other than that, I feel better than I ever have before. Why is that? He shoveled in a mouthful of eggs, his appetite as hearty as that of the tiny intruders which had undoubtedly begun to settle into his gut. The yellow pallor of his skin had already warmed to a healthy shade, and even in his disheveled state, he appeared in better condition than when I'd first captured him. The organism growing inside of you doesn't like a filthy home. It happens to be very particular about where it lays its roots. Can you not say that? It's gross. Don't like thinking about that. After only a few hours of agonizing detox, he'd become more compliant, even pleasant. It was amazing how manipulative feeling good could be. Barletta had probably lived a good chunk of his life in chronic pain due to his vices, and now they were gone. He likely didn't have so much as a headache right then. How does it clean? It produces a toxin, a very powerful toxin, that eliminates competing organisms and incites the mechanisms to repair cells. Lucky for you, the liver is the only organ capable of regenerating, so the toxin enhances the growth factors that increase cell division, resulting in rapid repair. Eyes wide, he shook his head and snorted a laugh. No idea what the fuck you're talking about, but whatever it is working. I ain't had one craving for drink. I don't feel all the pain. No shakes or the urge to puke. Nothing. He shoveled in another bite of his breakfast. Can taste again, he said around a mouthful of food. Smell. It ain't felt this good since I was a teenager. I don't even care to drink. Of course you don't. Elbow kicked up over the top of my chair, I casually watched him devour his breakfast, feeding the parasites that would soon emerge from their tiny cocoons and wreak havoc on his body. The toxin itself produces chemicals that essentially control the part of your brain that craves alcohol. Alcohol would be detrimental to all the work it's doing inside of you. It tells you that you no longer need it, and your body responds. What, like mind control? I smiled. Exactly. Halfway to his mouth, he paused in eating, staring off with a thoughtful expression. Then how are these worms so bad, if they do so much good? The urge to stifle a laugh tugged at my throat. Because they are parasites. It repairs your liver to feed. It cleanses your blood to feed. It uses your body to feed. And when it's finished, it will discard you as a used-up corpse. His thoughtful expression sobered into something more serious. Ain't there some kind of medication for it? Not yet. But that's what this is about, right? You're working on one. More or less. So, I'm gonna die? He asked, as if just catching on. Eventually. I shrugged. You were dying anyway, little by little, every day. I'd have probably given you a year at the rate you were going, if that. Frowning, he chewed slowly, as if tasting the bitter truth in my words. You don't strike me as a killer. So why are you doing this? I leaned forward and rested my elbows across my thighs. Because, like the parasite inside of you, I am only interested for my own selfish gain. Brow flickering, the man looked like he was about to break into tears right then. I got kids, man. A family. You don't give a shit about your family, I said without a speck of empathy. If you did, you wouldn't have hurt them. I didn't mean to hurt my son. His words shook out of him on a defensive snarl, and his eyes shone in the light of the naked bulb overhead. It was an accident. I don't mean to kill you, either. It's just a consequence. Then why don't you just let me go? A stab of pain struck my skull, the ringing in my ear sharp and intense, and I stumbled backward, teeth clenched while I waited for the agony to subside. Blackness crawled into my vision like shadow swallowing up the light. Sound faded for distant laughter. Let me go! The crooked army is coming, come on! My brother, Cademan, drags me by the arm down the long hallway of the cellar. Perhaps the scariest place in the old mansion that once belonged to my grandfather and his father before him. According to stories I've heard the nannies and maids tell, my great-grandmother's bones lie somewhere in this house, and I'm certain it's down in this cellar. The sticks we gathered from outside use a sword scratch across the cement floor behind us. We pretend an entire horde of the infected is after us. The ones we call the crooked men, who walk with a twitch in their step and enjoy the taste of human flesh. I follow Cademan through the halls, laughing as I try to keep up with them and keep from getting eaten by the invisible monsters with glowing eyes. The laughter dies away to a creepy quiet when we turn the corner to another hallway and come to a screeching halt before a cracked door, one that's usually locked, my father's office and laboratory. It is forbidden to enter, but maybe one peek won't hurt. "Father will be angry if we go inside," Cademan says beside me. He's only 3 minutes older than I am, but he acts like he's the boss all the time. "Father is always angry." I step toward the door, using my stick to push it open. "Have you ever seen him smile? I certainly haven't." A grip of my shoulder stops me in place. "Devrick, don't. Let's go." I wrench my arm from his hand. "Don't be such a chicken," I say, twisting back toward the door. But the darkness there brings me to a stop, and I'm a little ashamed to admit, it scares the bejesus out of me. "What is it that you want from inside? I'll get it." "I want to see her." The only picture of our mother lies in father's desk drawer. I've seen it a mere handful of times in my life, as my father sometimes enjoys tormenting Cademan and I by showing us how beautiful she was. She died giving birth to the two of us, and therefore my father has crowned us, specifically me, as I was the latter to be born, as her murderers. "What's the point, Devrick? We never knew her, and we never will." The irritation of my brother's words scratch at the back of my neck, and on a whim, I dash into the dark space. The temperature feels as if it's dropped 10 degrees, the air brushing across my skin like a ghostly whisper. From what little light streams in through the cracked door, I catch the shimmer of glass jars lined on shelves, ones that hold strange-looking creatures suspended in fluids. Skulls and books fill the space between the jars. More books sit in neat piles on counters in the floor. Silver tables gleam with cleanliness. My father is a stickler for neatness. The room is hundreds of years old, with a morbid history. My great-great-grandfather was a renowned doctor in the early 1900s, known as the Beast of Bramwell Estate. He was arrested for the very gruesome experiments he performed on prostitutes looking for abortions. The stories terrified me growing up, and I often had nightmares about him, which kept me out of the west wing of the mansion where his portrait hangs beside the other Bramwell men. His crimes plagued 2 generations of our family, up until my grandfather helped to develop a vaccine against a virus, saving thousands of lives. My father says that was when we finally crawled out from under the Bramwell curse and were once again respectable. I want to be like him someday, my grandfather. I want to do something incredible and save lives. Father's office lies past the laboratory, and as I venture closer, I turn to find the closed door of the refrigerator. The body fridge, where the dead are stored. Sometimes men bring big bags that they carry down to this laboratory. Sometimes I spy and catch them pushing carts of bags into the fridge. "Bah!" At a rough shake of my arms, I let out a scream. Cademan belts out a hearty laugh. I hammer a punch into his shoulder, earning nothing more than a grunt from him. "Asshole!" While rubbing his shoulder, he laughs again. "Should have seen your face." Attention returning to the fridge, I nod. "Do you think there are bodies in there now?" "Probably." I stare at the gleaming silver surface, on the other side of which could very well be a dead body. "Have you ever been curious what they look like?" "No." "Not even a little?" Cademan groans with irritation, and at a nudge to my arm, I stumble a step to the side. "You came to see a picture. Look at the picture and let's get out of here." "Why are you so scared?" Eyes trailing over the room, he snarls his lips. "I hate this laboratory, this office. I hate everything about it. Father says his work is going to save lives." I want to believe that, truly, but I know my father's true nature. "Only good men save lives, Devrick. Father isn't a good man." With another nudge from my brother, I keep on in my intended task and round the perfectly tidy desk to the other side of it. Clicking on the desk lamp sends a reflective shine across the spotless desktop. After running my hands across it, I open the drawer beside me. A picture frame lies tucked within, and I lift it out to an image of the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. Eyes a fiery amber, hair as black as ink. There is no doubt where Cademan and I inherited our most notable features. In the photo, she's looking over her shoulder, a bright smile on her face, her eyes sparkling in the light. It made sense why my father loved her so much, and why he obsessed over her. She was an incomprehensible light in his darkness. "What are you doing in here?" At the sound of the furious voice, my muscles jerk in fear and I drop the photo. Clattering against the wooden desk, it sends tiny shards of glass scattering over the shiny surface. My mother's photo dislodges from the frame on impact. Panic rises up into my throat as I lift my gaze toward the man standing in the doorway. Perhaps there was a time when he was handsome, worthy of my mother even. But right now, he embodies the very essence of a monster. Brows pinched to fury, eyes blazing with madness, he stares toward the mess I've made. "What have you done?" he growls through clenched teeth, just like a monster. "He didn't mean it, Father." Cademan pleads on my behalf, but I know it's no use. "You startled him." In what feels like no more than a blink, he storms across the room toward me. I should run, particularly when I feel Cademan tugging on my arm, but my muscles are frozen in place, eyes fixed on my mother. Cademan lets out a cry as, in my periphery, the monster pushes him out of the way, sending him backward into the wall. Something flashes at the corner of my eye, but before I can make out what it is, an intense pain strikes the side of my head. Jagged light flickers behind my eyelids. The room tilts. An unyielding force strikes the other side of my head. Cademan screams. Everything turns black. Quiet. So quiet, I can hear the thud of blood pulsing in my ears. I blink my eyes open. My father is standing over me, holding Cademan by the arm as my brother claws at his grip. "If it's the dead that fascinates you, then you will sleep with them tonight." The darkness slinks back into its shadowy corners, the view opening to my surroundings. I glance around at all the jars, ears and fingers, and other bits of meat I can't identify, all suspended in fluid. The specimen closet, situated beside the corpse fridge. "No, no, please!" Intense ringing blasts inside my ear as pain strikes my skull again. Eyes clamped shut, I grind my teeth, clutching either side of my head. The light shudders with the slamming of the door, and as I lurch for it, I hear the lock click from the other side. "No, please, don't leave me here!" Warmth trickles down my leg, the smell of piss burning my nose. A cold sensation, like ice crystals crawling beneath my skin, slithers from my neck down to my fingertips, a thick, numb throbbing in my hands, and when I lift my arm to wipe away tears, I can't feel anything. Not my skin, nor the closet's rough floor beneath me. Only an agonizing tingle lingers with the pressure. "Father, please, help me!" Cademan's screams echo through the door, growing distant, distant, until all is quiet. "Hey, hey, what the hell's going on? You okay?" A familiar but unfitting voice from my memory invaded my thoughts, yanking me back into the present. I blinked out of the void and found myself on the gritty concrete floor where I must have collapsed. "Do you give a shit?" I asked, pushing to my feet. Dizziness hooked my brain, jostling my field of view for a moment, and I stumbled to the side. Fuck. I hated coming out of these dreams. "Yeah, I give a shit. You're my meal ticket. I'm guessing the only person that knows I'm down in this shithole." He leaned back against the wall of his cell, watching me compose myself. "So, your father, he made you sleep with them corpses?" What? Had I verbalized the memory? I'd only ever had them alone, so I wouldn't have had any awareness. "You were talking all kind of spacey. Said your brother and you were playing where you shouldn't have been. Your father hit you." Hit me was putting it mildly. It so happened he'd struck a very specific part of my brain, consequently dislodging and activating a latent congenital prion disease. Zygliomyositis was the technical term for it, or Vonerich's disease, as it was more commonly known, a rare condition only seen in an exceptionally small fraction of the population. Incurable and unstoppable in its destruction. Rubbing my temples, I had breathed through my nose, banishing the mist of confusion still clouding my head. He was like you, Mr. Barletta, terrified of anything that might challenge him. He was weak, impatient, utterly detestable. Ain't there a small part of you that cares about your old man, though? Even if he knocked you around, you still gave a shit about him, right? I snapped my eyes open, the acerbic response sitting on the tip of my tongue and begging to be said. Instead, I swallowed it back, mostly for the sake of my blood pressure. To answer your question, yes, he did make me sleep with the corpses. I spent the night hearing things, whispers through the walls. Whether it was my father trying to scare the ever-loving fuck out of a 12-year-old boy or something else, I suppose I'll never know. Barletta stared off toward the center of his cell. My old man was a hothead, too, always flying off with his fist. He tapped a finger against the side of his head. He used to say my brain was made of stone, as many times as I got hit and got back up. You and I have nothing in common. A pathetic shame darkened his eyes as he glanced at me into the floor. Yeah, I guess not. He fidgeted for a moment, seemingly deep in thought. My death? It'll help someone. I shrugged. Perhaps. If nothing else, it will give me a better understanding of the toxin, so I can save lives. His brows came together, and he didn't bother to look at me when he asked. Is it painful? Yes, I answered in a flat tone. But no more painful than what you've inflicted upon others. He flinched and covered his face with his palms. Without the alcohol shielding him, I imagined his guilt was eating him alive faster than the worms hatching in his belly. This is fucked, you know? The way I am, the way I feel. I could really turn shit around, do better with my life. Yes, I suppose in some alternate universe you could have. Unfortunately for you, I found you first.
Chapter 14. Lilia. Wind howled at the window as I lay in bed, staring out at a dark sky. Classes would begin first thing the next morning, and no surprise, I couldn't sleep. The heavy ache of exhaustion burned in my eyes, but every time I closed them, my head spun with thoughts. Probably didn't help that my stomach growled incessantly. Seeing as I wasn't yet ready to head down to the dining room myself, I'd eaten nothing more than a granola bar from the vending machine on our floor. One that hadn't filled me up much. Earlier, I'd ventured to the Dracadian bookstore, an absolute monstrous building packed with students buying supplies and books and even some of the Dracadian merch they sold there. Most of my classes had opted for online texts, meaning I only needed the few books that I'd neatly stacked on the shelf above my desk. Noting the time on the clock was just after midnight, I climbed from the bed and crossed the room to the south window, beyond which the moon's light glistened off the ocean's dark surface. Staring out at the expanse of black water, I imagined myself out on that sea, alone, adrift, terrified of what lurked below the water. For weeks after my mother passed, I'd had dreams about the sea, even though it seemed as foreign to me as outer space. I'd felt hands pulling at me, the water reaching for my mouth, the icy cold embrace crushing my ribs. Voices I hadn't recognized telling me to let go. Below the surface, I'd see my mother, so calm and still, as if she'd fallen asleep. At the first sight of black worms slithering past her blue lips, I'd shake awake, panting and trembling. As time went on, I'd slipped less and less. 10 hours to 7, then 6. Nowadays, I'd been lucky to get 4 in a night. Sleeping pills weren't an option after the insurance had run out, so I'd suffered through lack of sleep, nodding off in class and throughout the day. My only saving grace was that I had knack for acing tests. Otherwise, I'd have probably failed out of every class. With a long and tired sigh, I stood staring. In all my twisted thoughts and nightmares, I'd never once anticipated how mesmerizing the sea would be. How utterly magical. Even in what little I could make of it from my window. How calming. Vast. I liked that it made me feel small and insignificant. that it could be dark and domineering, yet beautiful at the same time. A flickering movement caught the corner of my eye, and I looked down to see an insect hopping across the sill. A black moth, from what I could make out. I'd never personally seen a black moth before. Bent at an odd angle, its wing looked injured and left behind a fine black dust on the white sill. Moths had always scared my mother, for some reason. Whenever one had managed to fly into our house, she'd chased it with a broom, smashing it to bits of guts and dust. I stuck out my hand, letting the creature hobble onto my palm, and studied its wounded wing, noting tiny gouges that looked oddly like bite marks. It fluttered its good wing, tickling my palm, and with a smile I placed it back on the sill to resume my vigil. As my muscles loosened and my focus waned for an oncoming trance, the sound of rattling carried across the room. Frowning, I turned toward the exit door, catching the slight movement of the knob. What the hell? At home, when the door rattled in the middle of the night, I didn't answer it because it was either Connor stumbling home drunk after a night with friends, or a street junkie looking for a place to crash. I was no longer at home, though. I tiptoed toward the door, watching the light from the hallway flicker beneath it. Someone was there, for sure. Scarcely breathing, I pressed my ear to the door for a listen. Silence on the other side. A chill brushed the back of my neck, ice-cold fingers over my nape. Unintelligible whispers tickled my ear, and I swatted there, twisting to find no one present but me. Shivers spiraled down my spine as I threw open the door. The corridor stood empty, swinging my gaze left, then right, showed no one. An object caught my attention, though. At the threshold of the door lay a crudely formed metal button with an iron cross etched into its flat surface. I stepped back and closed the door over the button, but it wouldn't budge beyond the small bit of metal. Frowning harder, I opened the door again and bent to pick it up. The voice arrived louder that time, as if someone were there, bent forward alongside me, and I jumped backward, slamming the door shut. The unintelligible sound echoed in my ear, not with the smooth cadence of a foreign language, but something strange and abrupt, unsettling. Clutching the button, I backed away from the door and climbed into my bed, throwing the covers over top of me. Too rattled, I didn't bother to secure my arm in the cuff as I peeked out of the blankets toward the door, watching the light from the hallway flicker with the shadows. Chapter 15. Lilia. Damn it, come on! I swiped my card through the reader, only to be greeted by the sixth red beeping light in a row. Come on! Twisting slightly to the left showed that the line of seven other students had already doubled in the last 2 minutes, all of them wearing irritated and impatient expressions. Humiliation gnawed at me as I swiped the card a seventh time. Another red beep.
Here.
An arm reached around me from the other direction, and I turned to see a tall blonde guy with bright blue eyes offer a half smile, as he swiped his card and punched number 2 on the pad below the card swiper. A green light followed. Thanks, I said, stuffing my card away, the pressure in my throat settling again.
Underclassman?
Sophomore.
Now, only juniors and seniors are allowed to dine at Derrigan Hall.
The two of us strolled at an easy pace toward the front of the dining hall.
Freshmen and sophomores are restricted to Kavik, unless we invite a guest.
Another blast of embarrassment warmed my cheeks. I didn't realize. I'm sorry. It was close to my next class, and I thought I could grab a quick lunch and go.
I'm Spencer.
A well-groomed hand prodded my arm as he held it out to me, and I gave it a weak shake. The guy reminded me of Paul Walker, with his boyish charm and the way his eyes naturally held a smile. Lilia.
Any chance you want to have lunch with me?
The way my chest instantly tightened when he asked that, one would have thought I was allergic to lunch dates. I was going to eat in the... Spence! Kendall, the tour guide from Langmore's office, sashayed up to him, both of them looking like Ken and Barbie, standing side by side. When her eyes fell on me, smile falling away, I wondered if she thought I was wearing the same outfit as yesterday. I'd chosen another sundress, one with blue flowers, but it was the same jacket and boots. I see you've invited a guest. Clearing my throat, I hiked a thumb over my shoulder, which actually had me pointing at the bathrooms behind me. I'm going to eat in the courtyard. Primped brows winged up as she offered a fake smile. How very boho of you.
Mind if I join you?
Spencer tipped his head toward me and a knot tightened in my stomach. Nothing against the guy, he seemed decent enough. I refused to invite distractions, though. My goal was to remain focused on studies and nothing more. Besides, what the hell would we even talk about?
It's okay if you'd rather not. No pressure.
He shot me a wink, and when I offered a silent nod in response, he strode off with Kendall toward the long table of chafing dishes. I opted for the cold bag lunches at the opposite side of the room, and it was only when I headed toward the exit with no cashier in sight that I realized he'd swiped his card and essentially paid for my lunch. Ugh, did you have to be such an asshole? As I passed one of the tables, I snagged a glimpse of the guy with copper eyes again, the one I'd bumped into the day before, sitting alone and staring down at a book. When those eyes found mine and he caught me staring, I snapped my attention away and consequently rammed my thigh into the corner of one of the tables. With a quiet grunt, I brushed off what would undoubtedly become a bruise in the next 24 hours. Once out of the building, I took a deep breath and, on spying an empty bench beneath an impressive red oak, I hustled across the lawn toward it. After settling, I tucked into a chicken salad croissant with grape halves and celery, Cape Cod potato chips, and organic apple juice. Even cold lunch at Dracadia was more impressive than anything I'd have scrounged back home. And mine had been only one of about 10 different cold bag options. Lichen-covered statues, chipped and aged with time, stood about the courtyard in front of me. Angels and children with motherly figures who cradled them. I glanced back at the ominous gargoyles perched outside of the engineering building to my rear. How creepily they'd been angled, as if watching the innocent statues play. Across the yard from me, black birds pecked about. The infamous ravens, I guessed. I'd read in the history of the school that because there were so many that had flocked to the island, it was long believed to have been cursed. They made for pretty peaceful lunchmates, though. After eating, I headed toward Emmerich Hall for my first class of the day. Like every other building on campus, the gorgeous interior had been well preserved. Thick hardwood gleamed as I made my way to a set of wooden doors ahead. I opened one of them into a dimly lit auditorium, where a handful of students had already claimed seats and sat scrolling on their phones. Every one of them had the sleek, black, to-go coffee cups with the purple and gold dragon logo of the local coffee shop, Dragon's Lair, a pretty popular gathering place, as I understood. They had a few pop-up stands in some of the academic buildings, too. Unfortunately, $8 for a latte was out of budget for me. Finding a seat at the opposite side of the room, I sat in the very corner of the second row. Although I'd have ordinarily opted for a rear seat, with this being an advanced class, I wanted to make sure I didn't miss anything. Hoping to blend in, I pulled out my phone and spotted a text from Jay. "How's Anglican life?" Snorting a laugh, I texted back. Surprisingly uneventful so far. "I met a Paul Walker clone." "Met? As in talked to?" He spared me the humiliation of my card being declined. Guess he paid for my lunch, too. "Tell me you didn't eat alone, Lilia." "I ate alone." "Jesus, on a pogo stick! What the hell is wrong with you, woman?" "I'm not here for men. I'm here for knowledge. I can't screw this up. You know that."
"So is this seat taken?"
A shock of surprise jerked my muscles, and I looked up to see Spencer standing over me, his brows winged up, black to-go cup in hand, just like everyone else. A quick glance around showed a number of open seats he could have chosen. "Sure, I mean, no, it's not taken."
"Cool."
It was when he slumped into his chair that I noticed how uncomfortably close we were situated. Enough that if I hadn't turned my knees the other way, one would have surely touched his.
"Thought you said you were a sophomore."
"I am. I was placed in this class. I pulled my laptop from my bag, an off-brand loaner from the tech department, and a far less fancy machine compared to the MacBook that every other student had out on their desks. From the side of the chair, I tugged the small desktop to unfold it, frowning when it refused to flip up.
"Ah, you're a smarty pants then."
Spencer pressed a button I hadn't noticed, and the desk lifted with ease. Smiling, he tugged out his own laptop from his bag. A Mac, of course. While I appreciated his playful nature, I felt like every response fumbled inside my mouth. Though undoubtedly attractive, the guy wasn't my type, so it didn't make sense that I'd have been so tongue-tied. I'd do okay, I guess.
You missed out on a riveting conversation at lunch. Country clubs and fall fashion and everything I don't give a shit about.
He chuckled and I smiled, wondering if he'd said that for my benefit. Perhaps he'd hoped to make me feel more at ease around him, but unfortunately his comments only left me feeling more like an outcast. Just as I was on the verge of unzipping my skin and crawling away, a figure strode into the room. My heart stalled in my chest. In his black button-down shirt, black slacks, and black finger-raked hair, he looked like an ominous shadow moving through the lecture hall with the kind of lethal grace that had undoubtedly obliterated a few hearts. His outfit matched the infamous black to-go cup clutched in his hand. A tingle at the back of my neck had me scratching there, and when he headed toward the desk and lectern at the front of the hall, instead of one of the audience chairs, I wondered if he might have been one of the assistants Dean Langmore had mentioned. Bright copper eyes scanned the room. And when they fell on me, my heart slammed into motion again. The girl in the row in front of me lifted her camera, not so subtly snapping a picture of him. I stared down to see her posting a caption with a weary face emoji over it. Why does Dr. Death have to be so fuckable, though? Dr. Death? I nearly choked on my own spit right then. Bramwell, Dracadia's brilliant expert pathologist. Given his reputation and the respect he'd gleaned from Professor Wilkins back in Covington, I'd expected him to be 60 years old. The guy couldn't have been much past 30. He certainly dressed the part of death with all that black. A few more students filed in as Professor Bramwell stood at his lectern and cracked open a book. "Look away," my head told me. But he was one of those men that effortlessly commanded attention, the kind who went about his business looking utterly fuckable, as the crude brunette in front of me had pointed out. It irritated me how much of a distraction he posed in a class that was apparently one of the more difficult on my schedule. Once all of the students seemed to be present, Professor Bramwell snapped his book shut on a thunderous crack, and a unison of gasps echoed through the room.
"Let's get started. I'm Professor Bramwell, and this is my teaching assistant, Ross."
He pointed toward the front row, where a slightly younger guy sat wearing glasses beneath a mop of ungroomed hair that told me he must have been a grad student.
"The class is neuroparasitology, and we'll pick up from the parasitology prereq you should have taken last year."
The deep timbre of his voice vibrated in my chest, as I practically swallowed every word out of his mouth. The authority in his tone demanded to be obeyed, and as I glanced around the class, not one student had their face buried in a phone screen. I placed my phone onto the small folding table, opening up my audio app and clicked record.
"This is your first Bramwell class?"
Spencer whispered beside me. I gave a sharp nod.
"He doesn't like to be recorded. Kind of weird, I know. But if he catches you recording, he'll take your phone. All the notes are available on Drocknoti. You can edit as you go."
Oh, shit. In swiping up my phone, I knocked it off my small desk, sending it to the floor on a clatter. After retrieving it, I sat up to find those fiery eyes staring at me with such intimidating annoyance I had to look away, and clearing my throat, I held the phone in my lap. His eye twitched.
"It's imperative that you keep up and pay attention to the material. There's a lot to cover, and I'll be moving at a fast pace."
Gaze lowered, I prayed hard that the seat would fall out from under me and I'd get sucked into a black hole.
"So is there anyone here who has not taken the parasitology prereq?"
Oh, God. Just kill me already. I was the only one in the class who raised a mildly shaky hand. Again, those eyes fell on me. Hard.
"Name?"
"Lilia Vespertine, sir."
"See me after class, Miss Vespertine."
My first see-me-after-class since freshman year of high school.
"This class covers topics rooted in ongoing and privately owned research at this university, meaning you are not permitted to discuss whatever is covered outside of this institution. If anyone feels a sense of opposition..."
He pointed to the left of him.
"Don't let the door..."